Welcome. You all are the third case on our oral submission docket this morning. So if you are ready to proceed, I will have the clerk call the case. Counsel ready?
Ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Arrington, you may proceed.
Madam Justice, and may it please the court, this is an appeal from a child molestation case. Our client, Ray Lumsden, was convicted of aggravated sexual assault of a child, criminal solicitation of a minor, and indecency with a child, and received a life sentence on each. We've raised 14 points of error on appeal. I don't intend to go through all of them this morning. Mainly, we requested oral argument to focus on the hearsay issues. That's 4 through 7 in our brief, and also the issue of allowing the state to get into his extraneous offense. Like most child sex cases, this trial involved a great deal of hearsay. Not only the child's outcry statement to her mother, but what she supposedly said to the SANE nurse who examined her and the child forensic interviewer. And before I get into the hearsay, I wanted to just briefly address a couple of things in issue one. This has to do with challenging the sufficiency of the evidence to support his criminal solicitation of a minor conviction. As we're all aware, this statute has a corroboration requirement. First, we take issue with the statement in the state's brief that appellant's testimony corroborated the mother's testimony that on the night of the offense he gave her muscle relaxers before she went to bed. If you look at the citation to the record, the prosecution did ask about that on cross-examination, but appellant just testified she was already in bed when I got home. So kind of a minor point, but we take issue with that. On the corroboration issue, I think we're both in agreement that Lankford is the best case, Lankford v. State, which we've both cited to in our briefs, is the best case to look to on this issue. But even in Lankford, if you read the facts of that case, then the corroboration there was much stronger than in the instant case. That was the case where the defendant was alleged to have or convicted based on picking up a young man and taking him home, and during that car ride, he asked him to perform oral sex on him. And it was undisputed in that case that the young man was picked up and driven home by the defendant, and the victim's stepfather testified that he was visibly shaking and stuttering as he spoke. He saw him in the immediate aftermath of the alleged solicitation. He was standing at the back door with a rifle in his hands. He was still upset and nervous when the police officer arrived to take his statement, and perhaps most critically in that case, the victim used the same terminology as the defendant did in his later police interview when describing the act that the defendant supposedly wanted him to perform on him. So we don't have that kind of corroboration in this case. And as we stated in our brief, this appears to be an issue of first impression, but we do not believe that you can corroborate a child's in-court testimony with her own hearsay statements. No matter how many times she told the same story to people out of court, ultimately the source of all those statements is the same. It's the child complainant. We don't think that satisfies the corroboration requirement of the criminal solicitation of a minor statute. On issue three, this is the denial of his request for funds to have his expert come testify at trial. It seems we're mainly arguing over preservation, whether or not this error was forfeited. We think we've adequately briefed the reasonableness of the defense request in our brief, but I want to mention a couple of things. We do believe this issue is preserved for review. The defendant filed a pretrial motion requesting $6,000 in expert expenses. He was granted $3,000 without prejudice for additional requests if necessary. Then after the judge ruled at a pretrial hearing that he would allow the state's DNA expert to testify, then the defense said, well, in that case, I'm going to need our expert here to testify, and I would request an additional $1,500 to have her be here present at trial to travel from California to testify. The state says in her brief that appellant does not mention the trial court's denial of travel expenses in his motion for new trial. Our exact words in the motion for new trial were, By denying the defense request for travel expenses for Susanna Ryan, the court effectively deprived the defendant of putting on his defense. So we do think, even though the judge did not rule on that request at the hearing, it is stated in the record that he did deny that request. We also think that even though he did not mention, I don't know if it's pronounced Aki or Ake, I've heard it pronounced both ways, we've agreed to go with Ake for purposes of this oral argument, but the Ake v. Oklahoma, he did not specifically reference that case, but he did use all the correct buzzwords, if you will, in his motion. The defendant has been found indigent. The defendant remains indigent. It is necessary to the defense of this case for assistance of expert. A compelling need exists in this case for the assistance of experts to address significant issues at trial, one of which is DNA testing and test results. The case they've cited, Jimenez, for the support of their argument that we forfeited this claim on appeal, is in a posit for a number of reasons. The exact issue, if you look at Jimenez, in the heading where they discuss this issue, Jimenez was a writ case. It was before the court on habeas, and the issue was, may an Ake claim be considered when it is first raised in a post-conviction writ of habeas corpus? That is obviously not the situation we have here. Also, I'll go ahead and concede that an informal, off-the-record discussion, which is what they talk about in Jimenez, would not satisfy to preserve this claim for appellate review, but that's not what we had here. The trial court had a pretrial hearing that was on the record. The defense made a proper request for funds to have the expert testify at trial on the record, and we do have evidence in the record, although the trial court did not give him a ruling on the record, that he did eventually deny the request. Turning to the hearsay issues, issue four deals with the outcry testimony to the child's mother. We think that issue is pretty thoroughly briefed. I'll just make one point. The state says that the trial court, in her brief, the trial court had more than enough evidence before it to find that A.S.'s statements to K.T. were reliable. But a lot of the evidence it lists, this is on page 42 of the state's brief, came out at trial after the trial court had already ruled this testimony admissible. And as we all know, a trial court's ruling is considered in light of what is before the court at the time it made its ruling. We also dispute that the error could be held harmless, although we do have multiple, effectively the same hearsay coming in through other witnesses. The hearsay, the outcry testimony to her mother provided critical evidence, essential evidence of appellant's mental state that the child's in-court testimony did not. So we do not think that error can be written off as harmless. Issue five is perhaps the most complicated. It has to do with whether or not the nurse should have been allowed to testify, the sane nurse. Now, generally, if you look at the case law, then statements made to a healthcare professional during an examination are held admissible under the medical diagnosis or treatment exception. The problem in this case is that it's pretty clear from the record the child did not understand why she was there. And the defense actually, I mean, I don't know how it could get any clearer. He asked her on the record, did you know why she was asking you those questions? And the child said no. And even when the state put the sane nurse on the stand, she did not do anything really to lay the predicate that, for example, saying, I explained to her that it was important to be truthful. She pretty much just went right into what the child said. So there's really, yes, the statements were made to a sane nurse, but there's no evidence in the record to satisfy the predicate that the Court of Criminal Appeals has laid under Taylor v. State, that the child understood that the purpose of her making those statements was for medical diagnosis or treatment. Now, they've also argued that the hearsay she made to the nurse was also admissible as a second outcry statement. And we agree that the outcry is event-specific rather than person-specific, but the problem is, and it's actually right here in the state's brief. The state correctly argues that outcry witnesses can testify about different instances of abuse committed by the defendant. But on the very next page of her brief, she says that in this case, there was one instance of abuse, and we agree. This was basically that she was describing the same abuse, but in different levels of detail. And we've cited case law in her brief that says the judge is not to compare multiple different statements and determine which one is the most detailed. We think the case cited by the state, Polk, is also distinguishable. In that case, The complainant made a detailed outcry to her brother about the defendant's contact with her vagina, but she did not reveal that the defendant had also touched her anus in the same encounter. And then in a subsequent conversation with her mother, she revealed details about the defendant's contact with her anus. So that was a separate and different offense. In this case, she described all three offenses to her mother. She says, he touched my privates and my bum. And when she asked her if you saw his private part, she said, he asked me if I wanted to touch it, and I said no. So that's all three abuses, all three alleged offenses. Basically, on issue six, it's the sane nurse's report. We think that this was inadmissible for the same reason that the sane nurse's testimony was inadmissible. It did not fall within the medical diagnosis or treatment exception. The state did not lay that predicate. And as the state, I hope I'm not misstating her argument, but she seems to concede in her brief that the argument by the state at trial that it was admissible as her documents or finding as an expert, that is not a hearsay exception. And again, this error should not be held harmless because the nurse's testimony was more detailed and graphic than the outcry testimony of the child's mother. And also, there was something in the report about saying the child may have nightmares, flashbacks of the assault, or be afraid to be by herself. That surely inflamed the jury somewhat. Issue seven, this gets to the issue of whether or not the child's forensic interview with Priscilla Alboreto would be admissible. As a threshold matter, we do not believe you can lay the predicate for the admission of a hearsay as a prior consistent statement of one witness via your cross-examination of a different witness. The case law is not clear one way or the other, but the state's argument seems to be that appellant opened the door to the admission of evidence of this evidence by cross-examining Deputy Floyd as to whether posing leading questions to a young child can lead to unreliable answers. He did not cross-examine the child complainant. That is a very essential fact in this case. And in both of the cases cited by the state, Segura and Diaz-Gomez, in both those cases, the defendant did cross-examine the child complainant. So we think those cases are also in a posit. And I think this is probably the most important point on this. In addition to that, we all know a prior consistent statement must be made prior to the time that the supposed motive to falsify arose. Now, the state's made the same argument at trial and on appeal, that the child told the same story to her mother, to the sane nurse, to the forensic interviewer, and to the jury at trial. And so, since it's the same story, that means whatever motivated her to fabricate the allegations must have occurred prior to the initial allegation. And since the forensic interview was not conducted prior to that initial allegation, it's not admissible as a prior consistent statement because it was not made prior to whenever the original motive to falsify arose. Whatever motivated her to fabricate these statements must have occurred before she made the initial allegation. So, finally, even if you hold that was admissible as a prior consistent statement, we still believe it should have been excluded under Rule 403 for the reasons stated in our brief. And also, again, this error cannot be held harmless because the jury asked to watch the video during its deliberations. So clearly, at least some of the jurors were not convinced by just the outcry testimony and the child's in-court testimony. They needed to see that video. I think that shows that it had a substantial injurious effect or influence on their verdict. Issue eight, just really quickly, this has to do with whether Officer DeLeon should have been allowed to testify that it would be fearful for a child to look her accuser in the face. As we all know from the record, the child did not identify the defendant in open court, even after being walked out and asked to look around. She could not identify him, even though he was sitting right there. The state says that Deputy DeLeon merely testified as to his opinion, and a reasonable person could have drawn the same opinion under the circumstances. Problem with that argument, and I have a case on this, it's not in our brief, but it's Stevy v. State, 614 Southwest 2nd, 137. The pin site is at 139. Court of Criminal Appeals says, whenever the jury is in possession of the same information as the witness and can fully understand the matter and draw the proper inferences and conclusions, the witness's opinion testimony is unnecessary and inadmissible. So we don't think that he should have been allowed to testify to that. Finally, I see I'm running low on time. The issue of whether or not he opened the door to evidence that he'd been charged with creating false identities and tampering with a governmental record in Texas. The rule is very simple. A party opens the door by leaving a false impression with the jury that invites the other side to respond. And in this case, he did not do that. When he testified that he was sentenced to 20 years of probation in a felony harassment case and that he went back to prison in Minnesota on that case, but not voluntarily, he was telling the truth. He did not go back voluntarily. He went back because of this additional charge he picked up. We do not think that the state's case, the case cited by the state in her brief, Reese v. State, stands for the proposition, as they say, that any time a defendant testifies to only selective details of his prior arrests and convictions, his failure to disclose any other instances leaves the impression with the jury that those instances he did testify about are the extent of his prior criminal history. The defense in Reese, I see my red light is on. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Ms. Simmons?
May it please the court, counsel. I guess today I'll just go ahead and follow kind of the pattern that Mr. Arrington has started with. As to the first issue, as to the sufficiency, we did argue that much of the evidence had been corroborated. Appellant's testimony actually was inconsistent at times on whether or not she was in bed prior to him getting home or whether she was sick when he got home and he gave her medication. And as to the events in the beginning of that night. He did testify to two different stories, and one of those sides of the story did corroborate the same events that the victim in this case testified to. So we would argue, although her testimony was also corroborated by other events, such as the search of the house and all of the objects that the police were able to take into possession and the DNA testing, that appellant also corroborated her testimony in one of his various statements. As to issue number three, as to the Ake v. Oklahoma issue, the state would stand by that it was not preserved. The Jimenez case stands for that it there should be a written motion requesting it. In this case, it was apparent that appellant was also aware that that was the issue. He filed a written motion and obtained a ruling on multiple requests for financial assistance in this case for both his DNA expert and as well as investigators. And even though the court granted him money for an investigator, when he needed more money, he filed an additional motion before the court requesting additional funding, and the court would grant that. The only time he did not request in a written motion for the additional funding was relating to his DNA expert. And the court also went on the record to state, although he did state he would take it under advisement orally, there was an oral communication about it. There was never any ruling on the record, and there was no written motion before the court. So we would stand behind the fact of that one, that it was not preserved. And if I did make a mistake on the motion for new trial, regarding whether or not they had raised it in the motion for new trial, I still think that that's irrelevant because a motion for new trial is post-trial. And in order for him to have preserved the error, it would have had to have been done in the trial court. Moving on to the outcry of the victim's mother, I would just like to reiterate, as I think my brief shows out, that I'm not saying that there was only one offense committed here when he said that the state had conceded that there were just one event occurring. The state's theory on that, of course, is that this all occurred within the same incident. The indecency, the solicitation, and the aggravated sexual assault of the victim in this case all occurred during one time frame. At no time was this a different date or a different time of the day. They all occurred at one time. And so the ability of the mother to have been a proper outcry was proper based on the information given to her by her daughter. And just because she asked questions that resulted in the answers did not take away from the admissibility of her testimony. As to the SANE nurse, her testimony resulted in a different allegation. The victim in this case had spoken to the mother about the touching of her vagina and her anus. When she spoke with the SANE nurse, she mentioned appellant having touched and played with herself and swirling it around and asking her to do the same to his private part. Thus, that was a solicitation of a minor offense, and because that is a different offense than was brought out by the outcry witness of the mother, we believe that it was admissible because it was a different instance of conduct by a different outcry witness. As to the report of the SANE nurse, we do believe it was properly admitted as a statement describing sexual abuse for the purpose of facilitating medical diagnosis or treatment. Even if the prosecution did not verbalize that exception during trial, we still would argue that its decision of the trial court is within the zone of reasonable disagreement, and it was correct under any theory of law applicable to the case. Alternatively, basically contained the same information and aided the SANE nurse in her testimony, and she used it to refresh her memory. As to the forensic interview, the state does believe that you can attack a witness's credibility or the victim's credibility in this case, not merely by questioning her, but going to another witness and attacking the victim's testimony via that witness. And we think that when a party does that, they cannot protect themselves merely by not questioning the victim. Thus, because they did attack the credibility of the victim via another witness, they opened the door for prior consistent statements. Again, I think there's some confusion as to what the prior consistent statement is about. As is outlined in my brief, I do not believe that the prior consistent statement goes back to the outcry by the victim to her mother. As the prosecutor stated on the record, I'm talking about when the prosecutor was asking leading questions of a child victim in this case, that did the testimony not then leave that you're going to get unreliable answers by leading questions? The prosecutor was not talking about leading questions by the mother to the victim. He was talking about during trial when I'm asking her questions, I'm giving leading questions, and you're indicating through this testimony that that's unreliable. So at that point, he was able to show that her prior statements were consistent with her testimony at trial in response to the prosecutor's questions. The judge did get a little tangled up in that whole mess too, and on the record refer back to the mother's testimony. But again, we're kind of go back to the argument of correct under any theory of law. The prosecutor stated the correct argument, and that argument does sustain the admissibility of the forensic interview. As to number 8, although the child did not identify the appellant in courtroom, she obviously knew who he was. She was able to identify him by his name to multiple people, and multiple people, including his own biological son, came into court and identified him in the courtroom. So we think her failure to ID him was irrelevant. As far as the fearful of a child, could it be proper fearful for a child to testify in the presence of her attacker? We would say that that was an opinion, and a reasonable person could have drawn that same circumstance, especially in light of the fact that the appellant was making a big deal out of how this 8-year-old child had not identified him in court. And as far as the extraneous offense evidence, I think that my brief kind of outlines some additional facts than were outlined in appellant's, and although he was questioned multiple times about why he went back to Minnesota, he made various statements such as, he wasn't sure why he had to go back and end some probation deal and see the judge, and it was, you know, it wasn't voluntary. And that's very untrue. He went back because of what the other crimes he was committing here in Texas regarding him creating false identities and actually obtaining legal government documents from state and federal governments for a new identity that he was creating. And he was absolutely miscommunicating that to the jury. If the court has no questions, the state would just rest and give back my additional time.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons.
Thank you.
So on the AIC issue, just under Ray v. State, that which seems to be the controlling case on this issue, a ruling on the record is not necessary to preserve error in that case. Effectively, the defendant had to state on the record that his motion had been denied, and that's what we've done here. I don't think it makes a difference that it was done in a letter to the judge post-trial or in a post-trial motion for new trial, because both were presented to the trial court, obviously, and if that was – and also to the state. So if that was incorrect, then both the state and the court had a chance to correct the record, and they did not. To comply with 33.1, I think all we need to show is that there is something in the record indicating that the trial court ruled on the motion. On issue 5, as to whether or not the same nurse was also an outcry witness, if I understood my colleague's argument correctly, then it had to do with the fact that basically the child made – the child's outcry to her mother made allegations to the indecency with a child and aggravated sexual assault counts, but not on the criminal solicitation of a minor count where he asked her to touch his private part. On page 40 of the clerk's record, there is a copy of the statement made by A.S. to her mother that the state filed pretrial on April 1st, 2016. And it says in there, I'll use the initials, KT then asked A.S. if she saw Ray's private, and she told Christy that Ray asked her if she wanted to touch him there, and she told him no. So that's the criminal solicitation of a minor allegation. The fact that she went into more detail with the same nurse about swirling it around, that's the same offense, just more detail, and that does not qualify as outcry. Now, on issue 7.
Counsel, I'd like to understand that just a moment.
Yes.
The statements made by the child to her mother and to the same nurse were statements that are in a recent time to the event and with the attempts at verbalization by an 8-year-old child. I don't understand why what your argument is that the statement to Nurse Carricker wasn't a continuation of an outcry.
It was more detail about the same offense. There were three offenses in this case.
I understand that. The nurse said that he was twirling around his penis and asked her if she wanted to touch it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's different than what was said to the mother, and it's a different set of facts concerning conduct. And I'm not following your discussion and argument that is inappropriate as a part of the outcry.
Because, Your Honor, the criminal solicitation of a minor as charged in the indictment stemmed from him asking her to touch his sexual organ, in this case his penis. I don't even think the indictment used the term penis, but basically the outcry to her mother as presented by the state was that he asked her if she wanted to touch it and she said no. The fact that she went into more detail about him swirling it around and asking her if she wanted to touch it, that's the same offense. That's still criminal solicitation of a minor. She just went into more detail with the same nurse. And moving quickly to issue 7 and issue 9, the prior consistent statement. Again, we think it's clear under Hammonds and the other case law this did not qualify as a prior consistent statement. But again, we still have the Rule 403 argument on that. And I would say, specifically on the issue of him creating false identities and tampering with a governmental record, even if he did open the door to that, which again, he did not, because he did not testify falsely. But this is the very situation described by the Court of Criminal Appeals in Hayden. Unless the witness's testimony created a false impression that is directly relevant to the offense charged, allowing a party to delve into the issue beyond the limits of cross-examination wastes time and confuses the issues. Therefore, even if he did open the door, then the trial court should have sustained the 403 objection. Same thing with the forensic interview. This should have been excluded under 403, if not hearsay. One of the grounds that the Court of Criminal Appeals says you look at in Giglio Bianco is whether or not that this has an undue tendency to suggest decision on an improper basis. We think this kind of out-of-court testimony made and an interview with a Denton County employee without appellant. See, that's my time, Your Honor.
You can finish your sentence, counsel.
Oh, just basically, this is covered on page 52 and 53 of our brief, but basically we think that this is exactly the kind of evidence that Rule 403 should be used to exclude. And so we pray for reversal, and because of the novelty and complexity of these issues, we would just ask that your decision be published in this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Arrington. Ms. Simmons, thank you. We appreciate your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and court will be adjourned.
All rise.
Too much stuff.